This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to What Makes It Great. I am David Ozenberg. This is our fourth season of broadcasting this very popular series as hosted by composer, conductor, author, and commentator Rob Capello. For over 20 years, Rob has brought the joy and wonder of classical music and unraveling some of its mysteries to audiences of all ages and backgrounds. One of the greatest communicators since Leonard Bernstein, Rob's programs are characterized by his unique ability to create that aha moment for his audiences and collaborators, whatever their level of musical sophistication or naivete. Rob's work brings music into people's lives, opening new ears to musical experiences and helping people to listen actively rather than just hear. Rob's range of activities is astonishingly broad, including his What Makes It Great presentations, now going on for over 20 years in New York and Boston, his family compositions and family music events, his city pieces, corporate programs, and residencies with institutions as diverse as the National Gallery of Canada and Stanford University. The reach of his interactive events and activities is wide, from Native American tribal communities in Montana and inner-city high school students in Louisiana to audiences in Kyoto and Kuala Lumpur, and from little ones barely out of diapers to musicologists in Ivy League programs. His career has been marked by numerous major awards and grants. He won first prize in the Fontainebleau Casa des Sceaux piano competition and was second prize winner of the Entel Dorati Conductors competition with the Detroit Symphony. He's also been a recipient of an Exxon Meet the Composer grant and numerous ASCAP awards. He's conducted many of North America's orchestras, as well as new works of musical theater, ranging from the Tony Award-winning Nine on Broadway to the premiere of Frida for the opening of the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Next Wave Festival. At 19, Rob interrupted his academic work at Yale University to study with the legendary Nadia Boulanger. 2 years later, after graduating Phi Beta Kappa from Yale, he continued his studies at Eastman School of Music. After graduating from Eastman, he returned to Yale, where he was assistant professor for 6 years at the university. He dedicates his summer months to writing and composing new music. He was the first composer to be granted the rights to set Dr. Seuss's words to music, and his Green Eggs and Ham has been called the most successful piece written for families this half century. There's a CD featuring Nathan Gunn and Isabel Leonard in two of his most popular family music compositions, Chris von Alsberg's Polar Express and Dr. Seuss's Gertrude McFuzz. He's appeared on the NBC Today Show. He's presented a special What Makes It Great for broadcast on PBS's Live from Lincoln Center. And he's written two books, the award-winning All You Have to Do Is Listen and What Makes It Great, the first book of its kind to be especially designed for the iPad with embedded musical examples. His latest project is a new book on the American Songbook. And this is the very special rebroadcast of the live What Makes It Great that we staged just last Friday, November 30th, at Miller Chapel on the campus of the Princeton Theological Seminary. If you weren't there in person, we missed you. If you listened live, welcome back. And if this is the first time you're hearing this special broadcast, welcome and enjoy.
Good evening and welcome to What Makes It Great. I am David Ozenberg, coming to you live from Miller Chapel on the campus of the Princeton Theological Seminary. Tonight's very special event will feature four major choruses from George Frideric Handel's beloved and oft-performed oratorio, Messiah. Before we greet our host, composer, author, commentator, and tonight conductor, Rob Capello, I'd like you to welcome our musicians, our orchestra, which, since it needs a name, we'll dub for tonight the WWFM Handelian Consort, and our choir, made up of choristers from the Princeton Pro Musica and the Monmouth Civic Chorus. These singers were prepared by their artistic director of both choirs, as well as Amor Artists, a 40-voice chamber chorus and orchestra in New York City. He is on the faculty of Westminster Choir College and is one of the hosts of the Classical Network's widely syndicated and never duplicated weekly program, Sounds Choral. He is my co-host tonight. Please welcome Dr. Ryan Brando. Before Rob comes out, just a few words from you, Ryan. What are the major benefits and joys of leading a large community chorus filled with talented and highly dedicated musicians singing because they simply love the choral art?
Well, it is a joy, and it comes from that word dedication. These are people who are very busy and come from all walks of life, but they all choose to set aside several hours every week to come into a room, sit down, and listen to each other. And that's the deeper layer of it that really is a benefit to me. It reminds me that music can build communities.
You've prepared many a Messiah in your day. What are some of the areas you need to focus on that always need tender, loving care and that you look forward to making happen with your choirs?
Well, the first thing, you always have to blow the dust off the vocal cords, because as Messiah is famously full of all these runs of 16th notes, and those live a little differently in every voice box. So each individual singer has to find how she or he will navigate some of those more treacherous passages. And then we have to rediscover the text, rediscover what the libretto gives to us.
What makes Messiah evergreen and ever impactful and uplifting for you?
I think that there's something really universal about it. So many of Handel's oratorios, he wrote several dozen, focus on a named character, Solomon or Judas Maccabeus or Deborah. But Messiah is about more a concept. And so it's broader, and no one in the oratorio has a name. And so we think more about expectation and fulfillment and hope and joy and those broader themes. And I think that allows us to hear it every year and hear it in a new context and hear a new valence. You know, what does it mean to me this year? Because the story is more open in that way.
Yeah. So those of you familiar with the format of What Makes It Great programs, as you've heard them broadcast from Boston, Washington, D.C., or the home of What Makes It Great, Merkin Concert Hall at the Kauffman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan, know the usual layout of demonstration, intermission, performance, followed by a Q&A, with you, the audience, able to ask a question of Rob, the musicians, tonight the choristers, or Ryan, or me. Tonight's program will follow the songbook format Rob uses, meaning no intermission, and each demonstration of a chorus from Messiah will be followed immediately by a complete performance. But the Q&A session will occur after that final chorus performance, and it is now time, please welcome, the host and creator of What Makes It Great, Rob Capello.
Good evening and welcome to this special live broadcast edition of WWFM, What Makes It Great. Tonight's program focuses on Handel's Messiah, arguably the most famous choral work ever written. It's become an icon, like Mount Rushmore, never falling out of popularity from its first performance in Dublin in 1742 until the present day. Because of its iconic status, it's difficult to imagine that this amazingly confident, accomplished work composed in its entirety in 24 days. I mean, more than 2 hours of music in 24 days. If you're a composer like me, it's enough to make you sick. In 24 days, this amazing piece, more than 2 hours of music, was, according to Christopher Hogwood, Handel expert, quote, an offbeat venture, unsure in its rewards, and probably unrepeatable. Boy, was he wrong. It was composed in speculative, uncertain circumstances. For some 30 years, Handel had been known in England primarily as a composer, conductor, and producer of Italian operas. But by 1740, his reputation in the field had waned, his company had been downsized out of existence, and he was forced to reinvent himself with a new form of theatrical dramatic music, oratorio in the English language, designed to be presented in the theater during Lent. His first few oratorios met with only mixed receptions, and he was uncertain of the viability of the form. When he received an invitation from the Lord Lieutenant of Dublin, of Ireland, to compose a new oratorio, it was the first time in 30 years he had been asked to compose a work for performance outside of London. Messiah was unique in many ways for Handel. As Hogwood points out, quote, it is the only truly sacred oratorio he ever wrote. It was the only one performed during his lifetime in a consecrated building, and yet it was intended, in his librettist words, as, quote, a fine entertainment. Although quintessentially the work of a theater composer, it contains no drama in the theatrical sense. There are no warring factions, no Israelites versus Philistines, no named protagonist. The drama is revealed obliquely by inference and report, almost never by narrative. The text, compiled by Charles Jennings, is a skillfully arranged collection of New and Old Testament quotations that progress from prophecy through nativity, crucifixion, resurrection, the promise of redemption, all the way through, one long story. Messiah was also as unoperatic as any oratorio Handel would ever write. The original idea of oratorio was that it would be a kind of a sacred opera used for religious instruction, and Handel ordinarily took advantage of all the possible opportunities for drama. However, Messiah is different. It's more reflective commentary than drama, with the chorus, almost non-existent in opera, at the center of the work. Now, just a few comments and qualifications about tonight's program. Messiah is a work of enormous scope. There are enough different ways to approach this piece, literary, musical, religious, historical, to fill a dozen different programs and still barely scratch the surface. The piece also contains an enormous variety of music, and some of the most wonderful music is actually written for solo voices, which we're not even going to deal with tonight. However, to me, the heart of this work is choral, and it's the heart of the piece that I want to get at tonight. I've chosen four fantastic choruses from all the wonderful music in Messiah to focus on tonight to see if we can get past its iconic status and see what truly makes Messiah great. Though we're only going to look at a small amount of music tonight, I hope to give you a perspective that you can bring with you to the rest of the work when you hear it in its entirety, which you will undoubtedly do somewhere in one of the thousands of performances in the Princeton area in the month of December. So let's get started. Handel's greatness begins with his uncanny ability to compose amazingly memorable musical ideas. But what makes a great musical idea? In his book, The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell talks about advertisers, and he talks in particular about advertisers' search for what he calls a sticky idea, an idea or a logo that will stick in the public's mind and be easily remembered. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should is one of his examples, where the bad grammar, like instead of as, helps make the phrase memorable. Or Nike's just do it. As we're going to see tonight, Handel is the master of what I call the musical sticky idea. An idea that's both musically memorable, but also somehow managed to encapsulate in just a few notes the essence of the text's meaning. Often the tiniest differences can turn an ordinary, forgettable idea into a great idea. And at Handel, sometimes it's just a rhythm. We're going to sing for you the opening idea of And the Glory of the Lord with all of Handel's notes, but just one rhythm changed. After the altos sing my version, I want you to try it. So listen very closely. Here are Handel's opening nine notes with one rhythm changed. They'll do it, then you. Now you try it. One, two, three, sing. And the glory, the glory of the Lord. You sound fantastic. You want to come on up here? All right. Now, in Handel's version, which of the nine notes is lengthened? Which of the nine notes was lengthened? The third note. Now you try it. One, two, three, sing. And suddenly the word glory, which had absolutely no glory in my version, all the rhythms were the same, no note was special, and the glory, the, becomes glorious, and the glow. And then it rises higher and higher as lifted up by God's glory. This is a classic Handel sticky idea, both memorable musically and conveying the essence of the text, the glory of the Lord. Now, once you have a great idea, what do you do with it? Well, repetition has been at the heart of the popular impulse from Handel all the way to Bruce Springsteen. And these sticky ideas are often passed to all of the choral parts, imprinting them ever more convincingly in your ear with each repetition. The basses have the tune next. Men, listen, you're going to repeat after them.
Glory, the glory of the Lord.
Sing that with them, men. One, two, three, sing. Could you do that one more time with a little more glory on that third note here? One and a sing. And a glory. Excellent. I'm sure Ryan would not be happy, but I am. Good. Now, one of the things that makes Handel so special is his effortless synthesis of the serious and the popular. Yes, the basses repeat the same theme the altos just had, but the arrangement is completely different. Now the theme is in the basses on the bottom, but there are three new parts on the top, and the idea sounds completely different in this new setting. It's already being varied on its very second hearing. Instead of simply repeating, we have almost a call and response feeling. Call in the altos, and then the full chorus response. So we're repeating, but different. Here's that two versions together. Call. Response. I mean, doesn't that choir sound fantastic? Yes. And the idea for the rest of the sentence, shall be revealed, is equally sticky. Listen to it in the tenors.
Shall be revealed.
Simple idea, but even these simple ideas are subtle. For Handel, these two notes, shall be is already an idea. Shall be. A worse composer could have simply taken these two notes and done it three times, each time lower, and turned it into shall be revealed. A slightly better composer could have added one decoration and done shall be, shall be. But Handel gives you two extra notes, and that's what makes it so sticky. Shall be. Then the basses have the exact same idea, but starting on a different note. When we start a musical idea on a different note, we call it transposing. That'll come back over and over again. Here's the bass version.
Shall be revealed.
And the sopranos do it on a third note like this.
Shall be revealed.
Now, if having a great idea is step one, varying the way these ideas are presented is step two. And the incredible variety of ways that Handel repeats his musical ideas in this piece is simply stunning. Now, you've already seen two. Possibility one is to present the idea alone as a solo melody, the altos in And the Glory of the Lord, and then present it in a new combination with new parts above it. Possibility two, your experts, is transpose. Repeat the melody, but start it on a different note. And in fact, as we'll see in a moment, not only is this melody being repeated on different notes, each version is overlapping the previous version. It starts before the previous version has finished. Overlapping is a third technique. And as you'll hear in a second, the third shall be revealed overlaps with the final version of the opening of the sentence and the glory of the Lord to close the phrase like a musical bookend. So you have, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, blah, 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 and then back to, and the glory of the Lord, a musical bookend, which happens in the tenors like this.
And the glory of the Lord.
Now we're going to put the three shall be revealed together with our bookend and the glory of the Lord. And I want you to feel the excitement, and I want to see it in your bodies. The excitement as you hear that the third shall be revealed comes in faster. It overlaps earlier than the second one. It comes in after only three notes rather than seven. This is how Handel creates excitement. Here we put it all together.
Shall be
overlap. 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 Did you hear all the overlaps? Do you need one more time through? One more time through. Raise your hand when you come in so they can see it, and I'm sure the radio audience will appreciate that, okay? Let's do it one more time. Raise your hand when you do. Repeat that example. Here we go.
Shall be
overlap.
Shall be.
Got it? Very good. Now, the entire movement, whose text is drawn from Isaiah's prophecy, is amazingly made up of only two sentences. Sentence one, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. Sentence two, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it. Now, the two musical ideas for sentence two are equally sticky, and one of them is quintessential Handel. Let's learn together, and all flesh shall see it together. The altos will demonstrate, and then you'll copy. You try it. One, two, three, sing. And
And
what you notice is it's those three inner repetitions that makes the idea so incredibly sticky and easy to remember. Now, let's see how you remember. What do we call a musical idea being repeated on another note? Transposing, very good. How many of you are music experts and just knew that anyway? I don't want to know about it. Good. The tenors then transpose this idea, starting a different note, and I also want you to notice the witty little echo of "and all flesh" in the strings at the end of this passage.
And all flesh shall see it
echo.
Together.
Isn't that cute in the violins over there? Now, here is what truly makes Handel great. The idea "for the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it" could not be more perfect. Though the idea has 10 notes, there are actually only two pitches. It's more intoned than sung, as if by God himself in wonderfully God-like slow notes. And in a decision right out of central casting in Hollywood, who do you think gets to be the mouth of God? Sopranos, altos, tenors, or basses?
Basses.
Exactly. All right, here's their big moment. This is literally the mouth of God speaking to you in slow, godlike notes using only two pitches.
For the mouth of the Lord has spoken it.
An enormous event in God's life. All right, now. Having a great idea is one thing. Knowing what to do with it, how to continually develop it, is truly what makes this music so wonderful, and this is a perfect example. While the basses are speaking in the slow notes of God's voice, the women are speaking in the more excited, faster notes of "and all flesh shall see it together." Then, in an incredible moment, all the parts will flip. 200 years before feminism, already Handel believed in an equal opportunity God, and all of a sudden, the women will become the mouth of God, and then the men will take the "and all flesh" move. Repetition is at the heart of the popular impulse, but here the repetition is wonderfully varied and sophisticated. So you're going to hear the men do this, the women will be excited, then the parts will flip, and they will be the mouth of God, and they will be excited. Equal opportunity God. Here we go. Man,
four.
Excited women. Flip the parts. I mean, that's pretty fantastic stuff, right? Whooping is in the Handelian tradition, yes. Now you have a great idea and you've got great development. So how do you make a musical climax? Well, one of the things that Handel was brilliant at is using the different sound that a musical idea makes when a different part of the choir sings it, and in particular when they sing it in a different part of their range. When the altos started singing this piece, they sang it in a low, comfortable range like this. When the bassist sang it first, they sang it lower, but still in a comfortable part of their range, like this.
And the glory of the Lord.
Handel, genius that he is, saves the soprano version for the climax of the movement when they sing it in the highest, most brilliant part of their range. Now the glory of the Lord reaches its true glory, high A, the highest note in the entire movement. Here's the soprano version. I think they should get a hand for that, yes? I told them that the A was good, we'd hold it for another beat. Okay, good, good. And now register works the opposite way as well. Having reached the climax, the energy lowers by placing the mouth of the Lord lower, like this. Finish the movement by taking the end of the thought, which was always sung in this rhythm, "hath spoken it," and we slow the notes down to make a powerful amen-like conclusion like this. And now we'll hear the extraordinary first choral movement and the glory of the Lord, the opening chorus of Messiah. One of the things that Handel learned from 30 years of composing Italian opera was a sense of drama, in particular a kind of operatic shorthand ability to very quickly get across the dramatic essence of a situation. And he brought that ability with him into the non-staged world of the oratorio as well. You know, if you go into a church like St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City, you can see a moment of scripture encapsulated in a stained glass window, and you somehow take in the essence of a very complicated scripture story in one panel. And in a way, that's how Handel's music works. So often it takes one or two sentences of scripture for an entire movement and makes these sentences come so theatrically alive that they become a kind of stained glass window in music. The entire Messiah story is parsed into manageable sentence-by-sentence musical panels, so we can digest the story one sentence at a time. Though it lasts almost 4 minutes, "For unto us a child is born" really sets only one sentence, albeit an incredibly long run-on sentence, of text. The text is, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." Take a breath. One sentence, and it's as masterful an example of the art of the sticky idea as you'll ever find. Here's the opening section of "For unto us a child is born." For the sopranos, there, yeah. Okay, now the art of the sticky idea. I'm going to build up Handel's opening idea in three steps from ordinary to great, making a tiny change each time. Each time we're going to sing and you imitate. Now, in step one, every note gets the same rhythm like this. Try that. Ready? And sing. "For unto
us a child is born."
Which word do I lengthen in step two?
"For unto us a child is born."
Did I give it away? Which note do we lengthen? The first note. Do that one more two. Step two. One more time. I felt a little uncertainty out there.
"For unto us a child is born."
Try that with you. And.
"For unto us."
Now, which word gets two notes in Handel's version? Here we go.
"For unto us a child is born."
Born, exactly. Now sing it just like them. Ready? And.
"For unto us a child is born."
exactly. But as I've said, having a great idea is only the first step. Watch what Handel does with this idea, what he uses and what he notices, and how it generates the music of the next clause, "Unto us a son is given." First, he hears the possibility of that one special word with two notes. Us. That's it. It catches his attention. Those two notes of born, lower, become unto. Then we add one note, us. So born becomes unto us. Then we do it higher. Son is given, but we add an upbeat. A son is. See, we're constantly taking this simple two-note idea, becomes unto us, add an extra upbeat and do it higher. Son is given. Do the whole combination higher. Unto us, then the long one. A son is given. Constantly working with these tiny ideas. But that's not all. This is a lot of information for you to catch. And if Handel had run all of these ideas together, it would have become too busy and too jumbled to follow. I've written a version using all of Handel's notes, but eliminating all the pauses. A kind of musical run-on sentence. So here's my version. All the notes are Handel's. All I've done is eliminate the pauses, and here's a musical run-on sentence version. That is not great. Now listen to how the pauses allow you to follow the thought clearly and let each idea register. Listen to the pauses. Pause. What? Unto us what? You're kidding. Unbelievable. Pauses are the key. All right, now, once again, having a great idea isn't enough. Having a great idea isn't enough. It's what you do with the idea. After that opening presentation, the idea is repeated by the tenors. This is absolutely standard stuff. But then the tenor version is overlapped by a third statement by the sopranos. They repeat the idea, but they come in before the tenors are finished. Now, this is a little bit interesting. It's new. It's something different. I mean, this would have been a full day's work for Vivaldi. Not bad. Good, but not great. Now, here's that stock standard version, what almost happened with the tenors and then overlapping in the sopranos. This is what almost happened. Overlap. I mean, that would have been not bad, but instead of "for unto us a child is born," the sopranos do something astonishing. I want you to raise your hand when you hear the sopranos' inspired veering from. Here's what the sopranos actually do. I mean, that is incredible stuff, right? Now, this kind of ecstatic writing, many notes on a single syllable, is oratorio's way of expressing extreme emotions. Don't try that at home. Now, these notes perfectly express the joy and the amazement at the child who's born. And the most amazing part is that this blur of notes now accompanies and fills in those wonderful pauses that we heard in the original theme. So listen to the combination together. One with the pauses filled in by the joy and amazement of the sopranos. Overlap. Fantastic. Now, quick question. Who sang the fast notes in that version, women or men? Who sang the fast notes? Just say women even if you didn't know. Women, good, good. We want to convince the radio audience that you're really smart here. Okay, good. Now, just like in the first piece, everything flips, and now listen to how different it is when the men get to show off their fast notes and the women get to sing the theme this time. Men. A hand for the basses, yes, yes. Now, so often, pure rhythm creates character and a great idea for Handel. Here's an ordinary version that I wrote of, "And the government shall be upon his shoulder," but without Handel's unique rhythm. This is not great.
"And the government shall be upon his shoulder."
I thought they did an excellent job. Now I'm going to keep those notes and I'm simply going to add Handel's rhythm. And I want you to feel the character, the spine and the backbone that simply changing the rhythm provides. Not this. But this is almost Handel.
"And the government shall be upon his shoulder."
Now I'm going to add Handel's wild ending, and you'll notice that just when my spine and backbone rhythm starts to get really irritating and annoy you, Handel adds a wonderful new rhythm to end the thought, like this.
"And the government shall be upon
change.
His shoulder."
Now, here is what makes Handel great. That strangely long held note on shoulder creates a perfect opportunity for another voice to enter while one voice is holding that note. After that second entry, two voices will sing the whole thing together. Then a third voice will be added, the texture will thicken, and the words, "his name shall be called," will lead to everyone together singing the entire group. The entire community as one, calling out his names, the climax of the text idea, wonderful, counselor, the mighty God, the everlasting Father, and an exquisite, the Prince of Peace. Here's this full build-up to chorus as communal utterance of a nation's faith. Here is what makes Handel great. One voice, enter. Two parts, a third, and the violins usher in the climax. Aren't you glad you're here? And now we'll do the entire movement.
Oh.
Hosanna.